All right, the court calls, well, good morning again. The court calls United States versus Vasquez. This is a certified case, so the government will go first. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of this court, I'm Captain Tyson Kindness, together with Mr. Gerald Bruce, who represent the United States in this matter. The lower court erred by holding that the application of Article 29B and RCM 805D1 violated the appellee's Fifth Amendment right to due process, considering, first, the carefully designed procedural framework enacted by Congress and the President satisfied the balance to provide appellee a fundamentally fair trial and preserve the command's interest in maintaining operational readiness. Second,
do you agree the question is whether that's true in the application of this case rather than generally? In your brief, you weave in and out of saying they struck the right balance, thank you, go away, or whether you have to look at the balance that was struck as applied to the particular facts of the case.
Your Honor, the lower court's opinion definitely stated that the finding was a constitutional error as applied, but as I will develop throughout the argument, it's confusing to the government if this statute can ever be applied on a constitutional basis, given the court's analysis in putting so much weight into demeanor evidence. It appears that the court...
That being the CCA's analysis.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
But what is the government's position here today, regardless of what the CCA did?
The government's position is that it is a facially constitutional procedure, and it is a constitutional.
But one should look to make sure it's been applied in a manner consistent with due process.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Let's say we had your analysis case, to take for an example, and it was all done on paper except for two witnesses, neither of whom had anything particularly controversial to say for cross-examination, one of them introducing the evidence that of the person who observed the examination, and then someone giving a very routine description of the procedures at the laboratory, putting aside the confrontation aspects of all that, which we'll get to in another case. Why would you assume that the CCA would come out in the same position on a case that's virtually all on paper as they did in this case? I'm talking about your question, your suggestion that it could never be, that the CCA, with their analysis, could never constitutionally uphold such a case. I don't understand why, given the face of the CCA opinion, they wouldn't take a fresh look at a case that's almost all on paper.
Yes, Your Honor. And the court was allowed, permitted to, and did analyze this on an as-applied basis. So focusing on an as-applied basis, the government does intend to go through all the factors to show why there was no constitutional violation in this case.
Counsel, is what you're saying that it's hard to discern how Article 29 can be applied, can be unconstitutional as applied here and not facially unconstitutional?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's my question.
Yeah.
In a case that relies almost all on paper, why would you assume that the Air Force CCA would hold that to be unconstitutional when there's a change like there was a change in this case? I didn't see that in their opinion. You're arguing that this is not simply an as-applied challenge. It's a facial challenge because you can't conceive of a case in which the Air Force Court would say that there's that the Article 29 can be applied constitutionally. I'm positing a case in which everything is on paper except for two witnesses who testify in a manner that doesn't generate any cross-examination. Why do you look at the Air Force case, the language in the Air Force case, and say, well, the Air Force Court would not find in a case that's all on paper that Article 29 would be applied only in a as-applied manner, but it would also be facially unconstitutional? What is there in their opinion that says that they couldn't find the procedure to be constitutional in a case in which the government's presentation is all on paper.
The way they wrote their opinion, I guess to respond to your question, Your Honor, is that the court wrote it in a way where they could, at least they're saying that they could find in your scenario a case or imagine a case where it was applied constitutionally. But the weight that they've given to demeanor evidence, that's really what the court's analysis came down to in this case, was the importance of demeanor evidence, in that it is so critically important to confrontation, to the impartiality of the members, that essentially they're finding that the lack of demeanor evidence raises these due process concerns.
I think that's the source of the Senior Judge Efron's question, therefore, is, therefore, in a case where demeanor evidence is not in play, would you take the view that the CCA, I think this is what you're trying to say, is it necessarily the case that the CCA would determine it was unconstitutional?
According to the CCA's opinion, there's a footnote where they said, where they acknowledge that they're not overruling all hearsay statements because those statements lack demeanor evidence. So then I guess in that situation, when it was a paper case, Your Honor, then the CCA could come to a pure as applied analysis.
But you're here to argue this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you had some points you wanted to make.
Yes, Your Honor. The lower court first, in its analysis, erred by using the wrong legal standard for analyzing Article 29 and RCM 805 and saying that it didn't provide adequate due process protections. And they didn't apply the right test in the case. The appropriate test for evaluating whether an act of Congress provides adequate due process was articulated by the Supreme Court in Mendenhall versus Henry and Weiss versus the United States. As applied to this case, that test that should have been used is whether appellee's interest in having the same panel receive evidence in the same manner is such an extraordinarily weighty factor as to overcome the careful balance struck by Congress and the President in those procedures.
What are we to make of the fact that the CCA did not appear, at least I didn't see any reference to the congressional determination or the deference to be given to that, did you?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the first fundamental flaw that the government believes was in the court's analysis, because although the lower court appears, when you read its decision, to rely on United States versus Clay and these concepts and notions of fundamental due process and fairness, but the court didn't apply the right test, and that led to two problems, Your Honor. The lower court did not provide the required judicial deference to Article 29 in RCM 805, and second, it didn't hold the appellee to his burden to demonstrate the extraordinarily weighty interest in applying a different procedure. So to get back to succinctly answer your question, Your Honor, it led to two problems, that there wasn't the required judicial deference and it didn't apply the right burden in the case, which should be problematic to the lower court's analysis. Applying the appropriate test in this case, this court should find that the rules prescribed by Congress and the President provide adequate due process for the following reasons. First, just looking at the system that was designed by Congress, Congress intended to provide a fair but flexible procedure for replacing members after evidence has been introduced on the merits. We know this by looking at the plain language of Article 29.
Is this the only procedure that Congress contemplated? In this case, could there have been other ways of dealing with this?
Well, looking at the plain language of Article 29 and RCM 805, Your Honor, the procedure is clear, is that
that this is the exclusive mechanism?
Well, according to the rule, Your Honor, the mechanism to use is to reread the testimony back to the new members. Yeah, so that
but my question is, so it would have been improper for them to do anything else? So if the judge had declared a mistrial, you would have been up here on certification as well, saying, inappropriate, your only option was Article 29.
No, Your Honor. And the government absolutely recognizes that in the discussion section of the MCM under Article 29, it previously had contained an annotation that the judge, in these circumstances, should determine whether a mistrial is appropriate. That was actually left out of the 2008 version of the manual. And now,
so in the context of this case, the options on the table, in theory, were mistrial, Article 29, read back the transcript. Could they have recalled the witnesses and started over again? Is there anything? Would Article 29 have included that?
It would not have precluded that. It wouldn't have been in strict compliance with the procedure outlined in Article 29, but I still think it raises the same due process concerns, Your Honor, that the lower court found in this case by recalling the members. And the reason for that, sir, would be if you take the five original witnesses who have testified before the four original panel members, and then you recall them in to testify again, you still have a problem with, even though there's now demeanor evidence before the members, there's this problem that demeanor evidence or the evidence has been received in substantially different manners by the court members. And that really served as the basis for the lower court's holding, is they had a problem with the members receiving evidence in different fashions. So you can't have, excuse me, ma'am.
Oh, go ahead.
You can't have a situation where those five witnesses could say the exact same answer, or the counsel could have asked the exact same question, or they could have had the same exact mannerisms. There's still going to be a situation where the evidence has been received in different in a different way.
Why wouldn't a mistrial have been appropriate in this case?
In this case, a mistrial wasn't appropriate because the facts didn't call for it. There was no reason that the judge had to believe that there was a manifest injustice that was about to be caused by this procedure, given that the defense counsel didn't object. They expressly agreed with proceeding to trial in this manner. They even participating in narrating portions of the record in the government's case in chief. And then when looking as to evidence that actually came out, so doing your strict as-applied analysis in this case, the appellee himself, or his counsel, never stressed to the court why a witness's demeanor was so important in this case that it deprived him of a fair trial. And when you look at the record in this case, it's clear that the key concern from the defense surrounded the content of AM's testimony, not her demeanor and his statement at trial. The best evidence supporting this proposition is in the defense counsel's closing argument, which is contained in the record at page 697 through 720, where you see a portion of his closing argument, Your Honor, that's directed at AM's testimony. And when commenting on her testimony, there is no discussion as to her believability because of her demeanor or because of her gestures or some type of nonverbal cues. He attacks her credibility based on the content of her words, her inability to distinguish between the truth and the lie at the record page 701, her definition of her scariest day where she says, I fell down, her saddest day where she said, I made crafts at school. He attacks her the content of her statements, and there's no better evidence than at the record page 701, lines 8 through 10, where the defense counsel states to the members, you noticed how many questions I had for her members? Zero. Because this did not happen. And because when you look at her answers and you're evaluating her credibility, think back to exactly what she said.
So, does the government take issue with the cases cited by the appellant from the Supreme Court, Pointer, Berger, and Green, that deal with the importance of allowing the finder of fact to view and assess credibility? Do you take issue with those holdings, or is it your argument that those are fine in the civilian setting, but they do not apply in the military setting?
It's the latter of the two, Your Honor, that under a civilian analysis, those are applicable, but we have to look at a due process analysis under the Weiss standard, where it recognizes that military necessity can drive a different result.
And what was the military necessity here?
The military necessity here, Your Honor, was maintaining personnel resources for commanders. That is something that has been recognized by the law, is that the personnel resources are the most critical.
Where is that reflected in the record that they couldn't put anybody on the panel because they had some military emergency?
Yes, Your Honor, and there, the government acknowledges that there is nothing in this record that developed that point. But one of
is the government's view then, for example, in a death penalty case, to preserve valuable military resources, you could have a panel of one, for example, and not run afoul of the due process clause because it's the military. That's the Weiss standard.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. It does take an analysis of the facts of the case to determine whether a due process violation.
Looking at the facts of this case, was there any military necessity or military exigency that would, in the record, that would reflect that a mistrial was not an available option?
There is not, Your Honor. The government acknowledges the record was not developed on that point, but the reason it was not developed on that point was because, one, there was no objection by the defense counsel to cause a need to figure out whether there was some inherent military necessity in this specific case.
Counsel, I guess the thing I'm confused about is, I mean, the statute seems pretty clear, right? It says that this is the procedure that will be followed.
Yes, ma'am.
So I guess in my mind, the question is, unless the military judge abused his discretion and decided to follow the statute, can you speak to that issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, because you're not going to disagree that the military judge could have called mistrial.
Yes, Your Honor, given the fact...
And he could have recalled the witnesses sua sponte, even though it wasn't requested by the defense.
He could have if he believed that it was appropriate under the circumstances, but I don't believe that recalling witnesses is a good option, Your Honor, because of the problem that we've raised with it's just going to create now the panel receiving evidence in different manners. It could even lead to the situation where the witnesses come back in and they testify differently. And now because this process has played out, we now have inconsistent statements that have been created.
So you're asserting now that the military judge has no authority to proceed in that fashion?
No.
That is, would the military judge be violating the Constitution, Article 29, rules for court-martial, 805, anything, if the military judge decides to proceed in that fashion?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Then what's the point of the argument here?
The point of the argument is that the military judge always has to keep in the back of his mind this backdrop. Is he providing a fair process? Is the procedure that's going forward providing due process to the member? And here, the military judge had no reason to believe that due process was not being provided to the member.
Well, I mean, I guess one way of putting it is Congress made a determination of what process was due in this situation when it created statute, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was there any, whose burden is it to show that it's not adequate?
Under Wise, it's the appellee's burden, Your Honor, to show. And there was no showing of the lower court that burden had been satisfied. But there was also no showing that the lower court applied the appropriate test or employed the appropriate analysis.
But that's a different question than whether the military judge could have if he chose to have recalled the witnesses or declared a mistrial.
Correct, Your Honor. And as applied in this case, the military judge, we have to presume, given that there's no discussion on the record, believe that this was a fair process, given the fact that all, and Chief Judge Baker, I understand that my time.
Go ahead.
The military judge believed that the process was fair in this case because all parties agreed to follow Article 29 and Article 805 to the T. And in doing so, he was able to read back the record, which an important point from the government is the record is the best vehicle that courts martials use to replicate live testimony. We do it at the appellate level. We that's the one standard that we have in our system. So given that the military judge had an agreement by all parties and knew that he had a legal vehicle to replicate this testimony, he chose to follow Article 29 and RCM 805 to provide the evidence to the new members. And in its application, there was nothing that the defense in the case had showed that would have resulted in an unfair trial in following those statutes to a T. And given that my time has expired, sir, I will.
You have time on rebuttal as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellee.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honor, I will admit it's somewhat strange for me to be the second person going today. I actually had to call Mr. DeCito and say, where do I sit? Do I even stay in the same place? But it's a pleasure, obviously, to be before the court again. Your Honors, I would like to start with the questions Judge Ryan just led off with. In this case, Your Honor, I think the one paramount issue that the government is missing is that the government wants this court to overturn the Air Force Court's ruling regarding Article 29 and RCM 805 because they argue that rules for court-martial have meaning. They're correct. Yet the government wants this court to turn a blind eye towards the military judge's clear violation of RCM 915. The Air Force Court correctly ruled that the military judge erred when he failed to follow the mandatory statutory language of RCM 915 Bravo and inquire of the parties and the accused as to whether they believed a mistrial was appropriate under the unique circumstances of this case. He failed in his obligation to sua sponte declare a mistrial. As I will point out shortly, as a result, this court lacks its jurisdiction to hear anything more than the certified issue. As I will point out in a second, the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force did not certify that portion of the Air Force Court's decision to this court. As such, this court need not reach the certified issue and need not rule on the issue of military due process or the Sixth Amendment violation.
Now, okay, counsel, before you get into that, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but why isn't this whole thing waived? The military judge says, we're going to do it this way in accordance with the statute. Do you object? No. Okay, now the members are there. Now the new members are now there. Again, we're doing it in accordance with Article 29. Do you object? No. If that isn't waiver, what is it?
It's not waived for two reasons, Judge. One is that the military judge has a mandatory statutory obligation under RCM 915 Bravo to inquire of the parties, as I will address in a second. That issue never came up. The military judge never asked the parties, do you want a mistrial, as he was required to do. So the defense cannot waive, the appellee cannot waive what he has not inquired of. Secondly, there is a presumption against the waiver of constitutional rights, as I will discuss shortly in the Sixth Amendment arena. Military due process is constitutional and not waivable. The failure to object is not, and I'll get to the military due process issue in a second.
No, but you're asserting it's not waivable. Lots of things are waivable.
But constitutional violations are not, as the Supreme Court and this court has said. Your Honor, I would like to talk about the Air Force Court decision first. The Air Force Court decision rested on two separate and distinct legal principles. Completely distinct from any Sixth Amendment or military due process issue, the military judge had a statutory duty to inquire of the parties as to whether a mistrial
when you say statutory duty, what statute are you referring to?
You mean a rule-based duty?
For court-martial.
But that's only if it appears that grounds for a mistrial may exist,
and
correct?
And it clearly did in this
okay,
case.
Okay, but you're jumping to a conclusion that there's a requirement to inquire no matter what.
I'm jumping to no such conclusion.
Okay, so my question for you is, why would it's a variant on Judge Stuckey's question, which is, if the judge says, I'm going to proceed on this basis, do you have any objection? Why isn't that part of the grounds for determining whether a mistrial should inquire or not?
Because the RCM...
That seems to be a clue that the appellant, or whoever he is at that point, thinks it's a fair process.
Because RCM 915 does not say the military judge shall ask if the process of going, it does not use the language of 805 and say this is the process that we're going to use. The words have meaning in RCM 915.
But the premise that you are beginning from, which is that a mistrial was required, is versus the process that he followed, is the question that we're answering. You can't assume that.
I'm not assuming that, Judge. What I said was the language says if a mistrial may be appropriate, that the military judge has a statute or a regulatory obligation to inquire. And there are three important parts of that. If a grounds for a mistrial may exist, the military judge shall inquire of the parties. Well, certainly grounds for a mistrial may have existed in this case. We had gone through a process where the military judge was clearly on notice, and as the government points out, in two prior versions of the manual, it specifically used the language,
Why is he clearly on notice when he asks if there's any objection to following the procedure in the manual that's set forth in the statute, and the answer is no.
Because our
would the defense counsel want live members to see a four-year-old girl making these statements as opposed to having a bare transcript read to them?
Well, it's important to note, Your Honor, that she was not the only witness who had testified at this point. That five of the six witnesses...
But that's the witness that the CCA focused on.
I would agree with that, yes, Your Honor. I don't particularly think... I mean, obviously, she was the paramount witness in this case, as the government said. But, Your Honor, let me respond to that in two ways. The analysis to RCM 805 Delta, even in this version of the manual, still clearly states that this subsection provides a means to proceed with a case in the rare circumstance in which a case is reduced below quorum after trial on the merits has begun and a mistrial is inappropriate. So clearly the military judge was on notice that a mistrial may be appropriate in these cases. The rules tell him that.
How is a mistrial appropriate? Doesn't it all go back ultimately to the statutory balance struck by Congress in this case. You got a statute that says when you fall below quorum, this is how you work it. Leaving aside questions of waiver, the judge is applying the statute. How, other than on pure supposition, do we get to your premise on 915 that grounds for a mistrial may exist when all you're doing is following the balance struck by Congress? You're asking us to hold a statute unconstitutional, which is a very grave thing.
I'm not asking the court to do that at all, Judge, and I'll explain that in a second. The succinct answer to your question, Judge, is that same rule that says this is how you proceed if you fall below quorum. The analysis of that same rule also says...
Statute.
I understand the statute. I keep saying that, Judge.
Yeah, there's a rule and there's a statute.
I understand, Judge.
I'm concerned with statute.
Yes, Your Honor. But there is an analysis to that exact same rule for court-martial, which says this is what happens in the rare occurrence when you fall below quorum and a mistrial is inappropriate.
Wait a minute. You're stacking the analysis of an RCM against a statutory balance struck by Congress, and you're telling me go look at the analysis.
I'm telling you that is one of the things that this court can look at. The court can also look at the fact that if one were to take the government's argument, and I think the senior judge's question was sort of along these points, although in the opposite end of the spectrum. If you take the government's analysis to its most logical conclusion, you could have a case in which, and we'll use this case as an example, all the witnesses testify for the government, all the witnesses testify for the defense, and while they're in deliberations, or right before going to deliberations, we find out that all the panel members need to be struck. Well, if you take the government's argument to its logical conclusion, all you do at that point is you bring in a whole bunch of new panel members and you read them a cold record of trial and you say, forget about the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, forget about the fact that the Supreme Court has said that demeanor evidence is part of the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, forget about the fact that this court has said that the right to confrontation applies to courts martial, and simply say, we'll just read you back a 1,000-page record of trial and let you decide what happened.
Counsel, as I understand the government's argument, it was not that. That the government didn't argue that Article 29 precludes the judge from granting a mistrial. The government didn't argue that Article 29 precludes the judge from having witnesses called or recalled. Let's assume that the judge has all the powers. Article 29 says that the court martial may proceed, and that it doesn't say may proceed only by reading the records, this may proceed. So let's assume that the judge has all three authorities, mistrial, proceeding with just reading the record, or proceeding with recalling witnesses. Let's look at the words of 915B that you're focusing on. On motion for mistrial, or when it otherwise appears that grounds for a mistrial may exist, or otherwise appears. Is that an objective test on appeal, and that is, do we look objectively and determine whether grounds for a mistrial otherwise appeared?
I would answer that question with two parts, Judge. I think the succinct answer to your question is, yes, this court can look and say whether or not grounds for a mistrial may have existed at that time. That is, I think that answers part one of your question. But the other part of it is, the immediate sentence after that is the one that says, he shall inquire of the parties. So there's two parts to it. There's one, whether or not the grounds may exist, but two is that very mandatory language of the RCM that says he shall inquire.
I may be reading it differently from you. It struck me that the motion or the otherwise appears language is a predicate, and that's a condition preceding the requirement to inquire. The judge doesn't have a unhinged duty to inquire as to the views of the parties on the matter. Rather, the duty only arises if one or two conditions exist. Either there's a motion for mistrial or it otherwise appears to the judge.
Right.
So if objectively this court, and I'm not asking you to concede it, if objectively this court were to determine that the grounds for mistrial did not appear as a matter of law under the circumstances of the case, then there would be no duty to inquire. Is that correct?
I would disagree.
So there's a duty to inquire even if this court, as a matter of law, determines that it did not appear that there were grounds for a mistrial?
I would disagree, Your Honor. Simply focusing on what was happening at the trial level at that time.
I'm not asking you about this particular case. I'm asking you about how to interpret the rules. The question is whether the rule has a duty to inquire that is unhinged from the two predicate circumstances. One, either that there's an motion for mistrial, or two, that it appears that grounds for the mistrial exist.
Now I understand your question. And in that circumstance, certainly, Your Honor, I mean, those two things are what triggers the military judge's response.
Okay. So, in this case, is that not the core question from the perspective of the issue that you're raising and the issue that's raised by the decision before? And that is, objectively, as a matter of law, did grounds for a mistrial appear from the record?
I would say that that is the core question.
Okay. So what in this case made it appear that grounds for a mistrial were there?
Okay. And I would again argue, I would again point the court back to the fact that the rule for court-martial itself says that grounds for a mistrial may have appeared in this case, because it says that it's a rare case in which you fall below form in which a mistrial is not appropriate.
That's in the analysis.
Yes.
But
was in the comments.
Why does, in other words, does that mean as a matter of law, in every case, your point is appears to be that in every case where there's a replacement and you're going to use the record, the judge has a sua sponte duty to inquire as to the views on a mistrial that arises across the board per se?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I believe that that's what the rule for court martial envisions.
Well, what about the statute? The statute doesn't say any such thing, does it?
No, it does not, Your Honor. But again, the question from the senior judge was, what gave us reason to believe that a mistrial may, the grounds for a mistrial may have existed in this case? And there is, you know, rule for court martial 805, which says.
Well, let's get
to the. But talk about the facts of the case.
Okay.
I mean, the facts of the case that made it objectively appear that there were grounds for a mistrial.
Sure.
And factor into that discussion the not just failure to object, but affirmative participation in the process that they agreed to.
Okay, and I would sort of, I'd like to break that into two parts. I think the failure to object is somewhat separate and apart from, okay, now that the decision's been made, you've agreed to participate. In other words, once that decision's been made, I'm not sure that the Appellee's counsel's failure to, or agreement to participate in that decision should be held against it. But addressing specifically the question of waiver, Your Honor, as I was...
No, I'm not talking about waiver. I'm talking about, you're saying that there was objective grounds for a mistrial, and I'm asking you to factor into your discussion about those facts in this case the fact that they agreed to the procedures.
Okay, and I will, Your Honor. Okay, the objective grounds for the mistrial were simply, were this, succinctly. One-third of the panel is brand new. That creates several separate issues for this court to look at, one of which is it completely changes the voting dynamics within the panel. You go from 4/5 of the panel to 4/6 of the panel required for a conviction. So it puts on the defense the burden of an additional person to vote for an acquittal, so to speak. So secondly, the majority of the government's case had already been presented, 5/6 in the judgment. That's a fun with math yesterday. This one's a little bit easier for me. 5/6 is a majority. That much I can certainly conclude. And perhaps most importantly, and this goes back to, I forget which case, but maybe the Green case that I cited, but the essential feature, and maybe the Hilliard case, the essential feature of the panel had changed. And so this court says the Sixth Amendment applies to courts martial. The Supreme Court says an essential feature of the Sixth Amendment is the right to cross-examine witnesses and to have a panel or a jury, depending on where we're operating, observe the demeanor of the witnesses. That did not happen in this case for one-third of the panel. So those are the objective reasons why, and again,
But how does that distinguish this case from any case?
Well, I could use the senior judge's analysis, which is a case in which we're dealing with strictly a paper case.
But I mean, how does it distinguish this case from any case where it's not strictly a paper case? And how do we then justify, under the Weiss case, saying, well, Congress, you got it wrong?
I don't think you have to say Congress got it wrong. I think that you can resolve this case on two other grounds, one of which is one that I led off with, which is the issue isn't really right for this court. You can simply say, government, the TJAG did not certify this issue, so we don't even have to reach that. But two is you can decide it on Sixth Amendment grounds, clearly applicable to courts martial.
But if you were coming in here and arguing and saying, you know, once they did this with the panel, the defense, any additional witnesses, the defendant was not allowed to cross-examine them or see them, that would be a very different case, all right? But there's multiple facets to the Sixth Amendment, and there's only one facet that is not being shown here, right? Which is that some of the members did not get to see the demeanor of the witnesses. But the Sixth Amendment is not new, and presumably Congress took it into account when it came up with the procedures that it did in Article 29.
And I would also say that presumably Congress has taken it under account when they have decided that military due process is something that this court should look at in determining the overall fairness of a trial. And in this particular case, the appellant... Certainly military due process has been around for 60-plus years, and neither Congress...
Oh, you're arguing from inaction.
Yes, sir. Neither Congress nor the President has stepped in...
What's the last time this court use the concept of military due process to provide or deprive a service member of any right that was otherwise provided by statute or rule?
I'm trying to remember the exact case, Your Honor. I cited a 2004 case in my brief. I'm not sure if those words were exactly used.
Is there any case since Jacoby and Tempia resolve the issue of whether the Constitution of the United States applies in courts martial? Is there any case in which the court has used the term, not simply referred to the term, but used the term to provide or deprive a service member of a right that's otherwise provided by statute or rule?
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, the last case I recall is U.S. v. Gary's, but I could be wrong on that.
In that case, what was provided by military due process that wasn't otherwise provided by statute or rule?
The right to preservation of evidence.
And that's not that's a right that's not in the Constitution itself?
Not explicitly, no.
Okay. Is a panel a jury for constitutional purposes?
No, sir.
No, it's not.
Ryan noted that last
okay.
time in the Houston case.
We haven't ever held that there exists a right to the same panel throughout. Didn't we, in fact, hold the reverse in Easton?
You did.
Yeah. Okay. So, given our jurisprudence, how is there any ground for a mistrial arising under 915?
Your Honor, I think I've answered that respectfully in the issue of whether there's two separate issues. One is whether grounds for a mistrial exist and whether grounds for a mistrial may exist. So concentrating first on the 915 Bravo language, the appellee's first concern, we'll set appellant, I know I'm going to do that at least once. The appellee's first concern is the failure of the military judge to inquire. Second.
Well, no, as the senior judge pointed out, that follows from a predicate, and what I'm trying to get at is the predicate.
Well, and the predicate is twofold. One is the clear language of 805, which and the drafter's analysis, and it's not this. Your Honor, I think perhaps I'm not grasping your question, but I think the gravamen of this is it's not the manual doesn't say where grounds for a mistrial are clearly laid out in other rules for court martial. The military judge shall inquire. The manual says if grounds for a mistrial may exist. That's a pretty loose term that obviously the drafters intended to use. And in this case, the grounds may have existed as recognized elsewhere in the manual, and it says that if you fall below quorum, it's rare that a mistrial is inappropriate. Subject to any further questions from members of the court, I see that concludes my time.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Counsel.
Honorable members of this court, unless I misunderstood appellee's counsel, he stated that a constitutional right can never be waived. I thought it was that absolute terms, and I would just highlight for this court that the government acknowledges that a presumption exists against waiver of constitutional rights, but it does not mean that waiver of a constitutional right can never exist. Exactly in United States versus Hargrove, this court held that, quote, in certain circumstances, the defense counsel may waive constitutional rights on behalf of their clients. So I don't intend to belabor the point that there
are objections. Speaking of the Constitution, could you address this concept of military due process, and that is, does Gary's stand for the proposition that military due process is an independent legal concept that gives service members rights that are not otherwise found in the statutes, rules, or the Constitution of the United States?
The government believes that there is no independent analysis for military due process. It is a Fifth Amendment due process analysis that we conduct. The distinction that the government would highlight in conducting that analysis is directly applicable in this case when using the Supreme Court's case in Weiss. The distinction is that the court has to do a search to determine whether a procedure is fair. But in doing that search and relying on the verbs in Weiss, this court has to apply a presumption that there is a military necessity that existed for Congress to come up with a different procedure that doesn't exist in the civilian world.
Is this military exigency that you're talking about one that is just kind of out there? You don't have to make that in any particular case?
No, I think when Congress was enacting the statute, there's two ways to answer that question, Your Honor. There could be a factual basis in every case where the record contains evidence that there is a military necessity. But then also stepping back from a macro view, we have to also look back to 1950 when this procedure was being developed by Congress. And at that point, the court must presume that they developed a different procedure because they didn't want to do this case-by-case analysis. They recognized that operational resources are critical to the military, and be it in times of war or times of peace. Training for war is just as important as is actually
engaging. So we don't do, or we're not required to do, a case-by-case analysis?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is, from the macro level, we have to understand that Congress developed this procedure be out of military necessity, that we need to maintain as many operational resources as possible. But right. Then,
well,
when you
I thought we went through this earlier, that you weren't here. Are we trying? Is this a case about whether Article 29 is facially unconstitutional or not?
No, Your Honor. And then transition.
Would you concede that it's possible that there is a circumstance that a very clever law professor could invent that might lead to an unconstitutional application of Article 29?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the abstract,
yes,
not necessarily this case.
And given the government's research, we haven't found that case.
No, yet. I understand it would be very hard for the government to find it, but it might be out there, but you would concede that it could be out there.
Yes, Your Honor, otherwise there wouldn't
And be. You would, and it is also possible that Congress was not determining that when it passed Article 29 that it was making a constitutional judgment about the application of all amendments to the Constitution in the future in all Article 29 contexts?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so please stay focused on this case.
Yes, Your Honor. The distinction I was trying to make was that they originally developed a procedure out of a military necessity, but then that procedure still has to be applied on a case-by-case basis.
Well, they didn't, not military necessity in the narrow sense. They developed a procedure pursuant to their constitutional ability, their constitutional duty to make rules for the governance of land naval forces, and this is the balance they struck. And this is that not entitled to a certain degree of constitutional deference?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the degree of deference that it is entitled is that the appellee bears the burden to show this court why there is such an extraordinarily weighty factor in implementing a different procedure to overcome that careful balance.
Well, do they need to show it to us, or do they need to show it to the military judge at the time to say, no, I don't want you to follow this procedure?
Yes, Your Honor. The government believes that they had to show it to the judge at the time. That is the reason there was no sua sponte duty to declare a mistrial. But now, because we are in the appellate world, now the government does have an obligation to show this court why that There was no violation below.
But the extraordinary balance test, does that apply only to facial challenges? That is, all the cases in which the Supreme Court has addressed it, at least discussed by the parties, are cases in which there's been a challenge to the statute on its face. When the challenges to the statute as applied, is the defense required to demonstrate some extraordinary standard at that point to show as applied unconstitutionality?
Yes, Your Honor. The government doesn't read those cases to say that there is a different application when applying the Weiss standard, given if it's a facial challenge or an as applied challenge.
But in an as applied challenge, is the defense challenging the balance struck by Congress in formulating the statute, or is the defense challenging the manner in which that balance has been applied in this particular case?
Well, they definitely, to the government, it sounds like they've argued both, Your Honor, but they have argued as applied in this case. And as the government has argued as applied in this case, there were also no circumstances that gave rise to the military judge to find that there was some type of error being committed in this case. And unless there are no further questions.
Any other questions up here? Any other questions down there? Okay. Thank you very much, both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.